collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We are revisiting why we chose careers in service and what that says about us, about our families, and our communities. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Mike McCabe. Mike has been in international development with many U.S. government and U.N. agencies for over 35 years, yet he's stayed young at heart by working with emerging young leaders in many capacities. He served as the Global Youth Coordinator for the U.S. Agency for International Development and also served with the Peace Corps for over 13 years, as well as with the Inter-American Foundation and in many other capacities with nonprofits. So, Mike, thank you so much for being here and talking with me today.
Thank you, Kate. It's great to be here.
Can you recall the first moment that you knew that you wanted to do some kind of public service or international development work?
Ooh, good question. My origin story, I'd have to go back to growing up in Rochester, New York. We like to call it God's country, despite 200 days of rain a year. And my parents. My parents both grew up in small town America, the hills of Pennsylvania and Minnesota. And yet they somehow started this network called the Rochester International Friendship Council, which paired families in Rochester with international students studying at universities in Rochester. And so my house growing up was Bose from Nigeria, Tarek from Turkey, Klaus from Austria, all these international people coming through our home. And it kind of opened my eyes to a world way beyond where I grew up and gave me that bug of wanting to be out in the world. And so from that, I got more involved in also community service. My first community service was we hosted the International Special Olympics in Rochester back in the 70s. And that joy of being in solidarity with the special athletes just gave me a love for being in service together with other people. And so those experiences really set me on a path that always wanted to keep a sense of service for development with people around the world, and a lot of citizen diplomacy, but then transferring it into to more global diplomacy. And road leads to road in life, you know? And So I took a gap year between high school and college and traveled with a group called Up With People. And so we did service and performed in 90 cities around Mexico and the United States and around the world. And then after college, I set up my own year of service program to take college graduates to Mexico and Haiti. And that then led me down a path of working with UNICEF and Peace Corps, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and the Inter-American Foundation over the past three decades.
That is such a cool story. I'm also a fellow upstate New York kid. I grew up outside Albany. And it's interesting because my experience of growing up was that I felt like I didn't actually have that much exposure to kind of the world outside my community. I didn't know that many international kids. And so I kind of craved that. It was like the lack of that made me inspired to pursue more. And it's interesting that you were only 3 hours away and your parents were kind of bringing the world into your home. What do you think inspired your parents to be of service?
Yeah, you know, my dad was a chemical engineer. He grew up right at the time of, you know, Sputnik and the space race. And literally, he's in, you know, grew up in the hills of Pennsylvania, but he had a dream of, like, you know, all this exploration that was going on, both in the world and in space. And so I think he just had a desire to like understand the world more, and as did my mom. And they just loved hosting people, and that brought conversation into the house, and that brought ideas, and that brought kind of the desire to get out further. So
it's very organic. So in addition to your parents, who else has significantly kind of shaped your value system?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of unique in the sense that one of the people who inspires me from the beginning in college and then to this day is my wife, Rosie. She's been my partner both in public service and since our days at Georgetown and in marriage. And she dedicated her life as well to issues of domestic violence prevention and has worked at Department of Justice, at the White House, and other agencies on really creating system-wide policies and programs to address that. And I'd have to say dinner at the McCabe Hidalgo House can get pretty intense. Conversations sometimes over policies and politics, but we have a lot of fun. We always love to host a lot of our colleagues in from different parts of our life and public service and social change for dinners. And so having a partnered service as well is also linked to kind of the Jesuit ideals that I think I took out of Georgetown about being in service to others. But I'd also say I drew a lot of my early inspiration for public service as a West Wing fan with Martin Sheen. That show, I think, inspired a lot of people to serve, but it also reinforced the pride others of us who were in public service felt, seeing them take on the messy process of democracy and change. And so, surprisingly, sometimes Hollywood gets it right and can inspire a generation to be part of the solution through public service.
100%. And recently, I've actually been binging Madam Secretary. I don't know if you've watched that show, but yep. That's another one. Absolutely. That really shows the power of diplomacy and also the really kind of messy process that goes into ranking priorities and having to sacrifice in some areas for others. And I think for me, it's been a little bit of like medicine for the public servant part of me that misses the State Department, misses those conversations. And it's also, it's nice when you get to just watch it unfold and you're not responsible for the outcome.
Yes.
but yeah, I agree on Hollywood being pretty influential and inspiring sometimes. So back to your career in public service, I became aware of you and your work when I was working on youth issues at the State Department. You led the design and implementation of USAID's youth and development strategy. And I know that serving and supporting young people has been a through line throughout your career. What inspired you to focus on youth, and how do you kind of view the role of youth in responding to all the big challenges that we're facing today?
Yeah, no. I definitely have drawn my energy to do 30 plus years of service through my work with emerging young leaders. And I honestly always believe I have some of the coolest jobs in the US government because of the people I get to work with, both other public servants and then what we do together to engage young emerging leaders as partners in development. So Bobby Kennedy's quote about youth not being an age, but a state of mind and courageousness in taking on issues, as well as just open-mindedness, always resonated with me. And in those kind of amazing set of opportunities from working on grassroots development as a country director with the Inter-American Foundation and in Venezuela and in Nicaragua and Panama and Mexico, and then working as the first global youth coordinator at USAID, where I got to work with every one of our missions around the world and training our staff on how to better work in partnership with emerging young leaders on innovation and climate issues and democracy issues. And then finally working with Peace Corps with thousands of young Americans, typically, although our oldest volunteer was 82 years old, to serve in countries side by side with those community members. But the common theme was always this openness of young people to ideas and their humility to try new things and not be too cynical. Their sense of solidarity. I find it gives myself and all my colleagues that work in that space a lot of energy and a lot of hope when there's times where we doubt the system, where we doubt, the long-term effectiveness. But having that sort of opportunity to, on the one hand, mentor, and on the other hand, learn from young people. The things I'm learning right now on technology and the use of AI, I was at an event yesterday, and a young woman, a sophomore at American University, was talking about the role of AI in education. And the things that she was teaching the folks in the room was just mind-boggling about what it can do to change. And there's harm, too. And she pointed that out, too, and what she's doing to prevent online harm. But I was also this week with two of my friends from South Sudan at a Rotary event that we put on. Jock Abraham Thun, if you could envision it, is a 6'10", 150-pound young leader from South Sudan who I've known for about a decade. And he survived two massacres in his community, grew up in a refugee camp, and said, I want to turn bullets into books. And he came back from the refugee camp in Uganda and with six of his friends just started with, out of almost thin air and a very simple structure, a school for kids, because less than half of the kids in South Sudan even go to school in a structure. And so he started, and he started building out the Promised Land School. And today they have a formal structure because he figured out how to work through the U.S. State Department-funded Mandela program and got other people to believe in his vision. And they have 1,600 students in a really impressive school just outside of Juba. Our Rotary Club of Washington Global and the Rotary Club of Juba, we've funded a computer lab because his vision is to prepare other young South Sudanese, especially girls, in STEM education. And so with so many young leaders I've worked with at USAID and IEF and Peace Corps, they do magic with very limited resources on issues of violence prevention and literacy core work. And they're on the front line on pandemic response, including Ebola in West Africa. I mean, there were so many young leaders who were engaged through their sense of solidarity with their communities. And then entrepreneurship and new technology. So they give me energy, and I give them anything I can give them to help them be more effective leaders in development of their communities and countries. So,
yeah, well, what you give is also your experience. And yeah. I think that gets to the point of the beauty of intergenerational partnership.
That's right.
Kind of two-way mentorship. Everybody has something to bring to the table. Solutions to all the challenges we face as a global community cannot be engineered by one generation for another. And I think that also gets to kind of the most important piece of, we'll nerd out for a second on youth policy.
Yeah.
On youth policy, nothing about us without us. You know, that applies to so many things. And I think particularly at this moment where with the growing youth demographic in so many regions of the world, particularly in global South, global majority countries, we're seeing governments start to recognize, oh, okay, we have to figure out how to engage with youth better. But there's a difference between policy for youth or about youth versus policy inclusive of the views of youth. Can you talk for a second about that? Because you're really the expert on this, so I don't want to do this. I think you're the right person to talk to us about what does it mean to support inclusive leadership, inclusive governance?
Yeah, you know, it isn't that youth know all the answers or adults know all the answers that we call adultism. It is this partnership, and I think for the most part, young people know that they are thirsty for new networks of contacts and advice on how certain things work, especially when you're working in complex government or international systems. And yet adults at the same time need to be humble with what young people bring to the table. They bring these superpowers of their understanding of being digital natives and technology and what they're doing with you know, AI assisted or other things to solve problems in their community and in their country. So part of what we tried to do through the USAID youth policy, which was one of the very first policies of any international or bilateral agency, was to recognize there's an issue of access to basic services and resources that all young people need, whether it's in health or mental health or education or economic opportunity. Then there's this whole issue of agency. Mm-hmm. And agency is a really tricky topic, but how do you support people's sense of agency to take those resources they have and apply them and contribute them as a change maker in their community? And I know Andy Rabins at State Department was the youth coordinator there, was the youth coordinator at USAID. And we always used to say, you know, anytime someone says, hey, you're the hope of the future, stand up and walk out because you should say, I got too many things I need to do today to improve my community and my world. We can't put a pause button on young people, and yet we can't assume that young people have everything they need to successfully take on some of these really big, hairy challenges the world and their communities face. So it is that intergenerational partnership. But as adults, we often do a really crappy job of understanding the value that young people's point of view brings to sustainable solutions there. So a lot of what we are working to do and trying to do is say, all right, how do we help young people's voice by effective communication and public speaking? Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. I mean, we're all afraid to speak in public as young people or adults, but the more we strengthen that sense of confidence in communication, and then the network that they have to not be an individual leader out there, you know, just because you were a Mandela Fellow or a Wiley mm-hmm. Fellow or a Fulbright, but your role in servant leadership to collective action. And that's where the power is. And we see it in so many stories of impact going on around the world and in the United States, when young people understand how to use their leadership and communication skills to meaningfully mobilize other people, other young people, adults, to be partners on taking on issues. I was working at U.S. Peace Corps right before the change of administrations with a network called the Blue Pacific Youth Initiative. This was rural-based youth from Pacific Islands, and they were learning about climate change issues. I mean, they mm-hmm. live them every day. They've right. been impacted by tsunamis and seawater rise and all sorts of climate issues. But then to give their voice, to tell their stories, to talk about what they were doing for restoration of coral reefs or reduction of ocean plastics or whatever it was. And so it was a partnership. They were partnered with national leaders as mentors. They were partnered with Peace Corps staff and volunteers as partners. And then they were growing their own confidence in it. And, you know, none of them would have said they were confident or effective at the beginning of our Blue Pacific Youth Initiative. But to see their growth over the past 2 years was just stunning. And these, you know, they are going to be impact leaders in their community and in their country, both today and into the future. And that's the value that mm-hmm. investments by USAID and the Inter-American Foundation and so many other agencies have been able to do. We're building a pipeline of, you know, you and I have often talked about, like, there's the demographic dividend as peak youth happens in a lot of countries, and it's that unique moment you could actually get really big economic growth. And mm-hmm. we're starting to see, you know, countries get beyond the demographic dividend opportunity, obviously in a lot of the global north, but still in parts of South Asia and Africa, that opportunity is there. But there's this other dividend, which is called the democratic dividend. And that's what I'm really passionate about, which is research shows that the earlier you get involved in volunteering or being part of a group, the more likely you are to vote, volunteer, and be civically engaged throughout the rest of your life. So if we want to build robust, democratic, inclusive societies, starting early mm-hmm. on, and people are like, oh, you know, you can't imagine, you can't have like elementary school and middle schoolers out doing like meaningful service. And I will tell you, I've seen it happen dozens and dozens and dozens of times through the organizations I've worked with and young people who are leading on innovation mm-hmm. in entrepreneurship and social entrepreneurship and in other ways. So part of it is, yeah, young people operate often on very limited resources and do some pretty incredible things. And other young people are thirsty to find a way to be invited to be part of that. And so as mm-hmm. adults, we have to partner with them to help like clear those pathways for putting their passion into action.
Yeah, for sure. And as a parent, actually, I find it really exciting and empowering to think about that, because like there are days, you know, where our work can start to feel so challenging and you question, have I made an impact or not? And then I look at my kids who are inspired to do like lemonade sales. Or this weekend, my kindergartner played the bongos on the front lawn to fundraise for a local organization that helps at-risk youth. And like the fact that he felt empowered to do something, however small, to make a difference in our community shows me that like really planting that seed and planting it early is so effective. And it really does have a lifelong impact. So like there's always something you can do.
Yeah, those seeds create deep roots, and those deep roots create deep commitment to service, whether it's public service or community, national service, whatever form. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's really empowering to find something that you can do with your own unique gifts and talents. And I think the other thing to mention is when you're talking about youth being active participants in these kinds of projects, like there's a difference between tokenistic participation, where it's a seat at the table. That's how we think about a seat at the table, but maybe doesn't translate to real influence within, say, a political discussion or negotiation. So it's about a seat and a voice that makes a difference. And that's what we're all trying to work for. But now kind of turning back to you, I think your passion and your motivation is so evident to anyone who's listening to this conversation. But has there ever been an event in your life that has shaken your faith in yourself or in others? And how have you dealt with that?
You know, by nature, I like to think of myself as an optimist, mainly because the alternative is just too depressing. And so I try to remain optimistic on a lot of things in life. And sometimes I predict wrong on things. But the past few months, I think, have definitely shaken mine and so many of my friends who are in public services faith. And I'll be clear, you know, for 30 plus years, I've worked in Democratic and Republican administrations very closely with, you know, the senior leadership of any of those. And yeah, sometimes we approach policies differently, but most of the time we can agree on the principles and big outcomes that we're working together for. I think of the One campaign where, you know, when Bono came together with this incredibly diverse group of allies from the far right and left and just a very odd mix of people. But they said, we all agree on one thing, that we want to reduce the impact of HIV/AIDS in the world. And we have a pathway to do it. And he goes into the White House to George W. Bush. And you know, George W. Bush launches $15 billion to get PEPFAR going. So it shows it can be done. But right now, to see our most important and iconic agencies responsible for all our partnerships around the world, like USAID and others, dismantled in such a reckless way and often mean-spirited. It doesn't only hurt the 120,000 public service employees already laid off in just 3 months. It's damaged our partnerships with people and governments around the world. I mean, that we've spent decades building, you know, partnerships and trust with. And, you know, I can't tell you the damage this disruption has done to dissuading talented young professionals from coming into public service to work on public health and education and economic opportunity. I speak a lot at universities around the DC area on careers and development. And, you know, I could see the change happening, that they don't believe that this system is one that they are as excited as they were when they started college to get into, or that they're confident that the jobs will be there. And that's sad, because these are really talented people who want to serve our country on all sorts of issues to improve human development. And also, our agencies employ some of the best and brightest in countries around the world who work at our USAID missions and our embassies and other USG partners. And their trust in welfare has really been shaken and harmed. And so, you know, I want to be clear that we've deeply damaged our credibility as a leader and partner in the world and lost decades of developed programs that kept Americans safe and more prosperous. And we've helped so many people in need, and that's all been put at quite a lot of risk right now. And that is definitely shaken myself and a lot of people right now, and where we stand.
And we'll have to rebuild not only relationships around the world, but also the relationship between the American people and public servants.
Yeah, I would say, you know, it takes about 12 seconds to bring down a major building, and it could take years to build it. But when you're talking about trust and institutions, you're talking about, like, what we've destroyed in a few months will take us decades to rebuild in some cases.
So could you talk for a second about the connection between some of these programs that you're talking about and the development work that we've done around the world and national security, safety, and prosperity at home?
Sure. When I was a chief of party, my kids always loved that as the favorite job title I ever had, of a gang prevention program in Central America. So it was funded by USAID. You know, we were working with 40,000 kids from gang-impacted communities, and we were setting up youth centers in these communities. We were doing employment preparation programs. It was working both on violence prevention and community safety, but also on reducing the drivers of irregular migration to the U.S. So there was this one kid I worked with named Rafael, and he lived in Samaria, a barrio of just outside of Panama City. And he told me his story once, and he's like, you know, my mom was out of the picture by the age of 5. My dad was an alcoholic. I was in a school that could care less if I was there. And he said, you know, so I joined the gang, you know, for, quite frankly, he said, for my own safety in the community mm-hmm. I lived in. And I thought that was the safest thing to do. He got into, you know, drugs and the gang life. And at 15, he was shot through the face and left for dead. And he came across, he could have, you know, headed to the United States. He could have, you know, just given up on life. He could have joined another gang. He came across a guy named Pastor Manuel, one of my friends who ran one of our youth centers. And Pastor Manuel said, there is a second opportunity here for you. And he worked with him, and Rafael got into our life skills program, and he got into learning computer skills, and he got into our Youth Against Violence movement there in Panama. And he became a community leader there when he'd already given up on his life years before. And so instead of heading north to the U.S. or, you know, getting more involved in the gang, our program helped 40,000 kids into a safer pathway for their lives and away from irregular migration. And, you know, that's one drop in the mm-hmm. bucket story. That was a really small project for USAID. And yet the impact of it was tremendous on building safer communities that reduced people's feel of need to have to migrate out of their community, out of their country.
Yeah, and addressing the root cause.
Yep.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that's a beautiful story. And I'm sure, as you said, indicative of so many others that we will never really know. But this is kind of the thing that really gets to me. Like, I think that we talk so much about the abstract and about policy, and it's so important to hear these stories and to understand yeah. the real people's lives that are affected by
Absolutely.
Our policies and our change in policies. So now looking toward the future, and we know you're an optimist, so I'm excited for your answer to this one. What is your greatest hope for the future?
Well, we just had a granddaughter, so spending time with her.
Congratulations.
Yeah, no, you know, there's something about new life in this world that it's like, okay, on the one hand, she just like fills my wife and I with like hope. On the other hand, we're like, oh God, what is the world going to be like when she's, you know, mm-hmm. 20, 40, 60? But also about 3 years ago, out of the blue, I found that a bunch of my friends in international development were all part of the Rotary Club of Washington Global, a Rotary Club dedicated to international development. And Rotary, if you don't know, has like 1.4 million members in 45,000 clubs in 213 countries. And it's this experiment in citizen diplomacy and friendship and development that really kind of has been fascinating for me to get more involved with. I did not expect to be a Rotarian. Mm-hmm. And it's actually dramatically more diverse than I ever would have thought, probably more than it used to be. So networks like Rotary serve as a non-governmental network of citizen leaders. And that kind of inspires me because around the world, they're working every day to advance on issues, whether it's eradicating global diseases like polio or fostering peace building that they're working on, advancing, you know, universal education or just economic opportunity and entrepreneurship. And then the second half of it is, that has been something I've discovered, which gives me hope because there's these networks out there that are linking people who still have a sense of commitment and hope to these things. And I welcome anybody who wants to find out more, reach out to me. The second one is youth leaders around the world. They've always struggled with the lack of investment from mainline funders and the trust of adults and institutions. So that's actually made them more resilient, you know, because mm-hmm. I've talked to a lot of my friends who like literally dozens of people I've worked with in the field who were youth specialists or inclusion specialists. And we're like, man, you know, all the programs have been wiped out. What's going to happen to this next generation of emerging young leaders? And I'm like, they're resilient because no one trusted them with, you know, the big money before. They know how to leverage their superpowers of technology, numbers, passion, to have outside impact on issues they care about. So, you know, and I don't underestimate the challenges of youth programming and emerging young leaders. But in my conversations for the past few months with young leaders in the U.S. around the world, so many are deeply committed to speaking out on issues of polarization and dialogue, mm-hmm. The potential misuse of technology and the potential of technology for good. The, you know, they are speaking out on the abuse of human rights in conflict zones and on climate issues. So that gives me hope. But going back to what I said originally, that, you know, that democratic dividend where the younger a person starts in being engaged in an organization, volunteering, the more likely they are to vote and volunteer and advocate and be civically engaged as an adult. So, you know, I think back to another one of my mentors in life, Harris Wofford. He was the senator. Harris Wofford was one of the co-designers of Peace Corps under Kennedy. And then he became the first director of AmeriCorps back in the early 90s. And he used to talk about how we create these streams of opportunity of service into a mighty river of community, national, mm-hmm. and public service. And I think we need to see how service becomes, in his words, the common experience of all young people to build that democratic dividend.
That's an amazing point. And I think that sort of leads into something that I've been thinking about a lot lately, which is in the face of adversity, I think sometimes we see people become much more activated or inspired than they would have been otherwise. And maybe we have sort of been in a period of a bit of complacency, and we might take this opportunity as individuals, as citizens, as communities to find the areas where we can do the things that, you know, that fill the gaps that we now see, yeah. that have always existed or the ones that are new because our government has retreated from certain projects or certain initiatives. And I think what we can learn from youth around the world and what we will see with American youth as well is that they are only more motivated by facing these challenges and adversity. Not that we undermine or underestimate sort of the weight of those burdens, but that, as you said, youth display an incredible resilience and can inspire all of us. So, Mike, I've really admired your career from afar, and I was honored to be a part of the work, carrying forward the work that you did in your time at USAID and in partnership with the Department of State. And I am just so happy that we've had the chance to talk and kind of get to know each other better and become friends and partners in this continued mission to build a better world. So thank you so much for sitting down with me. And I also just want to thank you for your service in so many capacities over so many years.
No, likewise, Kate, thank you for the work you're doing to lift up the stories of impact of public service. And, you know, going back to whether it's Madam Secretary or Westwood, we need more of that communication going out to say why serving, you know, any of these agencies can be really important to our, you know, purpose-driven lives of making an impact in our community, our country, and our world.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for doing your part today.
Thank you. Take care.